history is often concerned with great events. Elections, revolutions, wars, battles, conquest, boom and bust. And we're used to reading history. That's why we walk away slightly confused when somebody says, "It must be borne in mind that my design is not to write history, but lives." This is the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Writing lives was the work of the Roman Plutarch during the 1st century AD. His concern was character, quote, "The most glorious exploits do not always furnish us with the clearest discoveries of virtue or vice in men. Sometimes a matter of less moment, an expression or a jest, informs us better of their character and inclinations than the most famous sieges, the greatest armaments, or the bloodiest battles whatsoever." Close quote. Plutarch's focus was, he said, the marks and indications of the souls of men. Dr. Pavlos Papadopoulos has been teaching Plutarch this semester, and I asked him about Plutarch's purpose in writing his famous lives.
When Plutarch says he's writing lives, he's entering into a conversation that we see in Plato and Aristotle. And both of those philosophers, they said that the two most respectable ways of life available to human beings are the life devoted to the common good, to the service to one city, the political life, and the life devoted to contemplation and wisdom, the philosophic life. And both Plato and Aristotle side with the philosophers and say that the most satisfying life for human beings, given our rational nature, is the philosophic life. Plutarch, however, focuses on those great men in Roman and Greek history who chose the other life, the political life. And what he does in focusing on those lives is he shows the great potentials of political devotion and the potential pitfalls. So he shows to us examples of how the ambition that's involved in being politically active can be channeled towards the virtues and towards the common good. And he also shows us how it can manifest itself, that ambition can manifest itself in vice. Accordingly, because he's focusing on lives as opposed to history, he's interested in character. He's interested in the little details. He says sometimes just a remark or a jest that is told by someone like Alexander the Great or Caesar reveal something about that person's soul in a way that their tactics at some great battle might not. So he leaves aside the exhaustive description of the histories that these men are involved in to focus on those traits of theirs that will reveal their soul and therefore reveal their potential, their capacity for vice and virtue and the choices that attend those traits.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only does he write lives, but he writes them in pairs. Mm-hmm. Comparing one life to another. Again, what did he have in mind in that?
The long title of the work is The Parallel Lives of Noble Greeks and Romans. And we find each Greek life paired with a Roman life and then a comparison, a short comparison, just a few pages written by Plutarch afterwards. What he's interested in there, I think, is distinguishing the characters by putting them up against someone who either had a similar character or found himself in a similar situation, and thereby seeing the divergences that certain character traits, certain virtues and vices, or certain choices could expose in them. What he's really interested in all of this, I think, is writing in a genre that we could call political biography, which might be part of political history. In so doing, he's really attentive to the role of choice and character in human affairs. Instead of giving us a broad, sweeping social history of Greece and Rome, he's really interested in the individuals who, while formed by their context and culture and political situation, made some kind of difference, worked within the scope of freedom that they had, and thereby revealed the importance that your moral character and your priorities make in your decisions.
Recently, your students read the lives of Solon, the lawgiver of Athens, and Lycurgus, the lawgiver of Sparta. To begin with, tell us a bit about each individual and then how they compare.
Yeah, Plutarch's interested in these men not because they founded the city, but because they reshaped their respective cities. When he says that they are the lawgivers of Sparta and Athens, he means that they laid down the comprehensive laws, the regime of each of these cities, which forms the character of all of the citizens who come after them. So Lycurgus is very famous in ancient history as the lawgiver of Sparta. What he does is he makes Sparta, Sparta as we know it. All of the movies and stories that we're familiar with about the toughness, the martial virtue of the Spartan warrior class. Lycurgus is responsible for that, for these this legislation that he laid down. He creates a regime that is very surprising to us as moderns. It's at the same time very egalitarian and very aristocratic or meritocratic. What he does is he seizes all of the land in Sparta, redistributes it equally among the citizens, eliminates gold and silver currency and luxury, breaks down family ties, and institutes common meals, sort of a cafeteria system for all the citizens to get together and dine and speak together every night, and introduces a very severe system of education in which the Spartan boys and girls learn to be tough, learn to resist pain, learn to be warlike and public-spirited. One of the examples that Plutarch describes in Lycurgus's education system is that the boys are routinely asked by their elders, who is the best man in the city? And it's demanded of them that they give an answer, a correct answer, and defend it well. And there isn't a list of correct answers that the elders are looking for. They really want to see whether the boys are able of making moral evaluations and backing them up. In other words, the young Spartans are trained to be concerned with the morality and the public spiritedness of themselves and their fellow citizens from a very young age, and are trained to what seems to us to be an extreme, a very extreme extent, public spirited, devoted to the common good, as opposed to the private good, as opposed to the individual good, or even the family good. It's a fascinating work to read because Lycurgus really does accomplish some real goods for Sparta. He frees Sparta of factional strife. There had been a series of assassinations of kings and attempts to institute other forms of government before Lycurgus' legislation. He makes it into a stable and disciplined military power, and he imparts to the citizens a love of virtue or of some virtues, as well as a selfless devotion to the common good of the city. But at the same time, the whole regime is built on some really abhorrent practices. There's a harsh and really terroristic slave system. The Spartans under Lycurgus practice infanticide for those children who are born and judged to be weak in body. And he breaks down family ties, including marital fidelity, all in pursuit of making the citizens parts of the whole of the city. So Sparta is a very extreme example, but it shows to us that there are competing goods that real-world political orders strive for, and that the immoderate pursuit of some of these can lead to genuine evils if we neglect others. One of the things Plutarch says about Lycurgus is he didn't make laws to fit the way things were, the state of things in Sparta. Instead, he used his laws to reshape the state of things in Sparta, to really form the souls of the citizens. 1,500 years later, Rousseau comments on Lycurgus, saying that what Lycurgus did is he suppressed the nature of man in order to make the Spartans into citizens instead of mere men or mere human beings. Again, Lycurgus's Sparta is an extreme example of citizenship, kind of citizenship almost brought to absurdity in its extremity or its completeness. But in showing us Lycurgus's Sparta, Plutarch shows us some aspects of political life that will always be with us, even if we don't go to the extremes that Lycurgus did. If we think about Solon, by contrast, Solon is the lawgiver for Athens. He accomplishes a much more moderate reform. One of the reasons for this that Plutarch points out is simple geographic conditions. The countryside that surrounds Athens can't support a large population with agriculture, and so Solon encourages Athens to become a commercial city. This leads to it being far more cosmopolitan and also far more permissive society than Sparta is. And it also leads to Athens being the home of great authors and philosophers that we're familiar with. Virtually all of the ancient Greek authors that we read are Athenians. And so Solon encourages the democratic character of Athens, which turns out to be one of its greatest strengths, as well as one of its greatest weaknesses, as we see in the execution of Socrates. Plutarch seems to admire Lycurgus more than Solon, just for accomplishing the goods that he accomplished and the difficulty of accomplishing them. But he's very realistic in judging them in comparison to one another. He sees how the circumstances limited Solon in a way that they didn't limit Lycurgus, and he admires Solon for the goods that he accomplished for Athens, even if Sparta seems a more admirable society to Lycurgus.
And what little things revealed their characters?
There's a good example from the life of Lycurgus. Lycurgus's brother was king before him, and when he dies, Lycurgus's sister-in-law is already pregnant with the first child of his brother, the former king. Lycurgus, immediately upon realizing this, when the kingship passes to him, he says, "I am going to serve as regent for my nephew, who ought to be the king." And it's a really interesting example, both of Lycurgus's public spiritedness, he's not ambitious to take the power for himself as other men might be, as well as his prudence, because he realizes that so many of the previous kings have been assassinated, and that he, if he serves as regent, he will sort of deflect the threat of assassination from himself. What winds up happening in the 8 or so months that he serves as regent before the boy is born is that he gains a great reputation for wisdom and justice and selflessness. And so years later, the Spartans call him back to reform their constitution. So he really lays the foundation for that reform in his virtuous, noble conduct during this brief period when he could have taken the throne for himself.
And Plutarch, I believe like Herodotus, tells the story of who is the happiest man with regard to Solon.
He does.
Would you?
Yes. So Plutarch takes this from Herodotus as one of his sources, among others. But what happened is that Solon established a set of laws for Athens, and then immediately afterwards, the various social classes were coming to him, complaining about one measure or another. So he realized he had to leave the city in order to have them become habituated to the laws. So he made the Athenians swear not to change the laws for 10 years, and then he, Solon, left. As he did, he toured the world. He went to Egypt. He went to Lydia, which is in modern-day Turkey. And there he met the great, extraordinarily wealthy king of Lydia, Croesus. Croesus took him on a tour of his treasuries and then asked a very pointed question after he's just shown Solon all of his wealth. He said, "Solon, who is the happiest man in the world?" And Solon gives a surprising answer to Croesus. Instead of flattering him, he says, "Tell us the Athenian, this man who had moderate wealth, according to our standards, who had good and noble children, who then had children of their own, who lived for Tellus to see his healthy and happy and noble children and grandchildren. And then he, Tellus, died by turning the tide of battle between Athens and one of its neighbors, and the Athenians celebrated him in his death with a monument." Croesus is outraged that Solon would pick this man who seems to have had a relatively insignificant life instead of him. So he asks, "Okay, who's the second happiest?" And Solon gives another example of Cleobus and Biton, who are two Argive brothers who are Olympic athletes, prize-winning athletes, who hitch themselves to a cart that their mother is in order to pull their mother to a temple where she needs to perform a sacrifice. They do so, their mother praises them, the whole city who sees it praises them. And then when they are celebrating the festival, their mother asks the god to give them the greatest gift human beings can receive. And the sons lie down and fall asleep and never wake up. And Solon gives this as an example of these men who perform this great noble service to their family and to their city and to the gods, and who are recognized for performing this service, were then given a peaceful death sort of at the height of their flourishing without experiencing any great tragedies in life. And so the lesson that Solon draws from both of these examples is you should not count on the durability of current prosperity. You also shouldn't measure it in terms of mere wealth and ambition, but in terms of public recognition and citizenship. Instead, you should wait until a man is dead to say whether he's happy or not. Did he live a good life in full? Every day may bring us some disaster that we can't foresee. So it's more prudent to wait until someone has died to see that they lived a good life and they weren't merely lucky at a certain given point in life. This winds up being vindicated. Croesus, even though he rejects the lesson of Solon when he's told it, years later he's conquered by the great Persian king, Cyrus the Great. And when he's put on the funeral, on the pyre to be burned alive with Cyrus watching him, he cries out from the pyre, "Solon, Solon!" And he realizes in that moment that Solon was right about present prosperity and not counting yourself happy until you've met the end of your life. And he's rescued from the pyre and has a great conversation with Cyrus. But this is an example of Solon's wisdom that comes from his life after he is legislated for Athens.
Well, I tried to read Plutarch back in fifth grade with very little success.
An admirable effort.
That being said, when I look back, I'm amazed that Plutarch was in our middle school library. Now, it's a long time ago. I doubt it's in middle school libraries today, but why would it have been there at all? What was the use that people have put? How have people used the book?
Yeah, Plutarch's life lives have been part of what you could call political history for centuries at this point in the West. Political history is an approach to history that focuses on the choices that are made by citizens and statesmen, and also on the nature of political regimes. Instead of taking a more macro focus on material or economic or social history, it really focuses on how our conduct influences the good of our nation or city, and how our character influences our conduct. This is no longer the dominant approach in the American academy or the American education system, but it used to be, and it used to be the approach, and political biographies such as Plutarch's used to feature in our education because it is a great component to civic education. We use the term civic education, and we usually mean something like knowing what's in the Constitution, knowing what jury service is, knowing the structure of our government. These are all important things to know, but they're insufficient. What we really need as a component of civic education is to know what kinds of virtues are required by self-government, what kinds of vices lead to the decline of republican government, what kinds of characters are produced by various kinds of regimes, how to distinguish between statesmanship and demagoguery. And political history provides endless examples of these topics, and Plutarch's lives are truly vivid examples of political ambition at its best and political ambition at its worst. So by providing stories or lives of these great men who did great and terrible things, Plutarch can help educate us to be better citizens, better judges of our fellow citizens and our politicians.
Modern Western culture is marked by endless debunking. There are no heroes anymore. When someone, a would-be hero, rises up, we begin to look for his or her feet of clay, or at least that imprudent, long-forgotten tweet, in order to hack them back down to size. Plutarch certainly understood, as we Christians acknowledge with St. Paul in Romans 3, that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That does not mean, however, that there are no saints and that there are no heroes. We and our children are not bereft of examples of men and women who may or may not have been Christian believers, who lived lives of goodness, virtue, magnanimity, and character. In addition to the lives of the saints, Plutarch can help us and our children rediscover the world of character and heroism. He supplies examples to follow and standards by which we can measure ourselves and others. And oh, for those fifth graders who are interested, there is a children's version of Lives. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.